over with the Pathfinder this morning. He's going to be teaching their lesson, and so we're going to just start right into our message this morning, and we're going to be in Jeremiah, and so you can turn over your Bible there to Jeremiah chapter 25. If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand, and we'll make sure you get one. If you didn't get a handout, we'll make sure you get one. I think everybody did. Very good. Very good. Jeremiah chapter 25. Now, this message is not complicated. Do you need one, Miss Barb?
Yes.
Okay, Miss Brother Eric can get that for you. Thank you, sir. Now, this message is not complicated, and I'm going to try to keep it not complicated. So I'm going to try to be simple this morning. The passage is actually fairly long, all things considered, but there is a very simple truth that I want to pull out of this morning. And so Jeremiah, one of the interesting things, once again, is that this message is not in, it's out of chronological order. And I think there's a reason, because there's a truth that they want to communicate to us. And so it pulls up an old message. Remember that this book is a compilation of all of Jeremiah's stories and interactions and messages, and he put them together. And so they are in the order that he put them in, even though they're not in order of how they happened all the time. And this is certainly true here. Jeremiah has been giving them a message about the sin of the people, what's going on in their life, and it's been hard. He's been pointing it out very directly. He's been pointing out their sin without really sugarcoating it at all. He's been saying it in as clear ways as possible, sometimes saying it in a way that we're surprised he would even speak. But he's giving them the truth. And the fact that it's hard for them to take is not his fault. It's their fault for having lived the things that he's pointing out. And so he tells them they're breaking the covenant. They're breaking the rules that they agreed upon. And so here we are, he says. The people didn't want to hear the message, though. They didn't want to hear the fact that their joys were going to be lost in the future. They didn't want to hear the fact that they had been doing wrong, because all their people have been saying they've been doing what's right. They didn't want to hear it. And so the priests and the kings and the prophets all said that Jeremiah is lying. He is saying something that is not fair. He's being more harsh than he needs to be. He's prophesying a future that's not going to happen. And they're trying to silence everybody. And last week we saw that he was encouraged by a view of two baskets of figs. One was good, very good. One was bad, very bad. And just like we can tell the difference between a good and bad piece of fruit, God says, I can tell the difference between those who are doing right and those who are doing wrong. And I will reward and I will judge accordingly. And it will be right and it will be just. And so in this message, though, last week's message was after the second deportation in their captivity, like immediately after. This week's message, he backs up in the timeline and goes all the way to the just prior to the first deportation of the captivity. And so that's where we're going to be today. But God informs Jeremiah the fact that he is still willing to bless and curse those on an individual scale. But here, he's going to go back to the national scale and look at what God's doing in the world as a whole. And I get my message title from verse 31, where God says that he has a controversy with the nations. And I thought it was interesting how he said that, because what I was feeling as I was reading this passage, what God was trying to answer, is that God, he had an issue with the nations. And what's very easy for the people to think as they're hearing all these messages from Jeremiah is for them to have an issue with God about how he's handling it. I mean, God's going to bring them through a very harsh time. A lot of difficult things they're going to have to go through. A lot of things that almost, some seem unfair, some seem like overkill. And in this passage, I think what Jeremiah tries to pull out in this message is that God's character is consistent with the things that he does. Because as soon as God does something that we don't like, instead of looking at ourselves, instead of looking at what we're supposed to learn from it, instead of looking about how we can grow or whether or not God did it on and he's just in doing it, or whether we deserved it or not, we tend to immediately point to God and question his character first instead of ours. God gives us the things that he does on purpose so that we can grow and be more like him, And yet our response is always to point fingers and say, why isn't God better than he is? Why did God allow this? Why shouldn't he have done this differently? Couldn't he have done this differently? But when we don't fully agree with what God is doing, we have to remember his character. And I think that's why Jeremiah puts this message here. Now, there's a lot of truths we're going to see in this chapter that we've seen before and we'll see again. So I'm not going to belabor those. But I want us to see a little bit of the progression of thought that he has. And so I'm going to ask us this question this morning. If we have the right view of God and his character when it comes to how he deals with us in our life, or do we spend our life, when God has a controversy with us, we have a controversy with God and say, God, I have some things to speak to you about. That's actually the way that Jeremiah phrased that one time. I have some words with you, God. And God has to respond and say, this is why I do what I do. So I'm going to give them to you very quickly this morning. I don't want to make this more complicated than it needs to be. So we're going to read a lot of the passage each time we go through. So five areas of God's character that should affect us to see what God is doing. Number one, first area of God's character that he really very clearly points out here is that God is fair. God is fair. This is one of the moment that Jeremiah is speaking about, we can hardly imagine. We have very little in our recent history that we can point to that can give us some type of a handle on what the Israelites had to go through here. What God is about to talk to us about, and what Jeremiah is preaching and prophesying about, is something that is very difficult and seems unfair. And throughout this book, what God has been doing is been pointing out the fact that it's not his fault they're having hard times, it is theirs. And so he does that once again here. So look at verse number 1. We're going to read down to verse number 10. The word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. So we know where we're at. If you look at your timeline, the fourth year of Jehoiakim is the first time the people were taken into captivity. And so this is just before this moment. This is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and this is when the message is coming out. Verse 2. The which Jeremiah the prophet spake unto all the people of Judah, to all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, saying, from the 13th year of Josiah the son of Ammon, king of Judah, even unto this day, that is, the 23rd year of Jeremiah's ministry. You add all those together, that's been 23 years Jeremiah has been preaching. Okay? The word of the Lord hath come unto me, and I have spoken unto you, rising early and speaking, but ye have not hearkened. The feeling with the book of Jeremiah is that Jeremiah starts, I mean, we can read Jeremiah if you really, really tried. You could read the book of Jeremiah in a day or two, and you'd be done. And we forget about the fact that Jeremiah ministered for 40 years. By the time the first deportation came of the captivity, by the time the captivity actually came on the people of Israel, he had been preaching for 23 years the same message. So it's not as if, because we can read the whole book in a day or two, that he just said, guys, you need to fix it. Oh, you didn't. Okay, sorry. It wasn't that way. He's been preaching now from the middle of a good period of time. Josiah's reign was good. God was blessing. God's word was available. And he said, there are some things that you need to work on. And they said, no, we're fine. Everything's fine. We're good. And then they weren't. And then Josiah died. And then the kings that were in charge reflected the people that were living in the nation. And things got bad very quickly. And Jeremiah continued to preach the same thing. And for 23 years, he has gotten up early. He has preached the same message. But they have not hearkened. Verse 4. The Lord had sent unto you all his servants the prophets, rising early and sending them. But ye have not hearkened, nor inclined your ear to hear. They said, turn ye again now, every one from his evil way and from the evil of your doings, and dwell in the land that the Lord hath given unto you and to your fathers forever and ever. And go not after other gods to serve them, to worship them, and provoke me not to anger with the works of your hands, and I will do you no hurt. They got up, they told you the message. Do what is right, do what God has told you to do in his law, and God will bless you, and you can stay, and you can enjoy, and God can use the land that he wants to give to you. This is an option available to you. But, verse 7, yet ye have not hearkened unto me, saith the Lord, that ye might provoke me to anger with the works of your hands to your own hurt. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and a hissing and a perpetual desolation. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth, that's joy and party, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstones and the light of the candle. It's obvious why he frames this way, the way he does. He doesn't jump right to the captivity. Now remember, in the timeline, the whole idea of this captivity might have been new news to them. It's not new to the book of Jeremiah because he puts them a little out of order of events. But this is somewhat new news to them here, that that's going to be taking place. But before he says it, he says, but this is a message I've been giving to you over and over again. God doesn't give you all the information all the time. Sometimes we're mad at God that he didn't somehow reveal to us exactly what was going to happen in our life if we disobeyed. But the problem is not that we don't know what's going to take place. The problem is that we do know how to obey, and we don't. We want God to tell us what to do and what not to do, and then what's going to happen if we obey, and then what's going to happen if we don't. He doesn't always give us the consequences, but he does tell us exactly how to respond. God does tell us exactly how to act today. And then when we wake up tomorrow having disobeyed him for years and say, why is this in my life? God's not going to have to apologize to us for not having revealed to us all the information, even since he's given us everything that we need to know. Because generally, people, just like children are, we tend to be sore losers. I'm a sore loser. That's why we don't play board games in my house. It's bad for our marriage. We play games that have the least amount of competition. Like, we can't play Monopoly, because Monopoly, the only way to win is to, like, decimate the other people. You can't barely win Monopoly. You have to destroy everyone in your family in order to win Monopoly. So we don't play Monopoly. The same is true of Risk. Have you ever played Risk? Yeah. The only way to win Risk is to completely destroy everybody else on the game board. So we like to play the games that when you win, you barely win. Like, everyone's doing well. Oh, you're doing so good. You almost got there. Yay. And we all go home happy, generally. We like the ones that there's hardly any competition at all, because what happens when you lose, or what happens when you don't get what you want, is you just want to blame everybody else. This is exactly what kids do, especially. Like, as soon as they lose, they pull up something that somebody else did 10 turns ago. If they hadn't done that, that was against the rules, then I wouldn't have lost. Somebody else was mean. Somebody else didn't do what they were supposed to do. It's somebody else's fault. You were distracting me. It's always somebody else. And that's how we act in our lives. As adults, when something's wrong in my life, it's always someone else's fault. Well, why did you react that? Well, they reacted that way first. Or why is this going on? Why is this what's happened? Well, I had to, or whatever. And this is what happens with our relationship with God. Then we point at God and say, well, God wasn't being fair. He lets us go through hard times, or he lets us lose something or someone important to us. And we cry foul as if we deserve something different. We deserved for God to react differently. It wasn't my fault. But Psalm 98 reminds us, I gave you the verse, before the Lord, at the end of the verse before, but he cometh to judge the earth with righteousness, shall he judge the world and the people with equity. Equity means equality. He will be equal and fair. God is not a respecter of persons. He is equitable. God used the Israelites because he chose to have mercy on them. But if the book of Jeremiah communicates anything to us, it should communicate to us that in spite of the fact that Israel is God's chosen people, he dealt with them equitably. He dealt with them the same. When they sinned like the nations sinned, he treated them like he treated the nations. God is fair. I'm going to give one more thing before we leave this chapter. You might have noticed I didn't read verse 11 yet. So look down at verse number 11. I want to point out a different point. This is actually new information to the book of Jeremiah The captivity has shown up here and there. And we've actually seen it take place a couple times even in the book. But this is new. Verse 11. This whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Now, we've seen already the book of Jeremiah has told us they would go into captivity. We've already seen in this book that they would go and they would come again. He's shown that. But as far as I can tell, it's the first time that he's actually said 70 years. Why 70 years? It seems kind of arbitrary, doesn't it? Seven is one of those numbers that just shows up in the Bible a lot. So whenever it does again, we're just like, okay, there's another seven. Why not? But why 70? Why does he go into captivity for 70 years? Why not 80? Why not 60? Why not 40? That seems appropriate. We like the number 40 a lot. The time of testing, that seems like a good amount of time for them to go into captivity. Why 70? Well, we could conjecture, but the Bible actually tells us this reason a long time before. I gave you the verse in 2 Chronicles chapter 36 when it records them going into captivity. It tells us why. Now, as far as we can tell, the 70 years begins with the first time they were taken in this fourth year of the king of Jehoiakim and ends with the reign of Cyrus in his first year when he sends them back with Zerubbabel. We could go into more technicality about that. That's not important. So that's where the 70-year block comes from. But the Bible tells us in 2 Chronicles 36 why. I want to read it to you. Long time ago in the books of the history, when they actually go into captivity in the timeline, he says this in passing, that they go to captivity, verse 21, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So from the first year of the reign of King Saul, the first king of Israel, until the first deportation of the captivity is exactly 490 years. According to the law of Moses, they were supposed to, there's a lot of Sabbaths. We talked about this a while back, and I mentioned in passing. There's a lot of Sabbaths in the land of in the yearly calendar. You had to have a Sabbath every week, which was a day of rest. That was the point, because we need a day of rest. God knows that, so he commanded us to do that. But one of the other Sabbaths that we had to keep is that there was a seventh year Sabbath. There were some social things you had to do where some things kind of got reset. But one of the things was that the land rested. And farmers know to do that now. You rotate your crops, and so every once in a while you pass that cornfield, next year you'll pass it, and it's just weeds. Why? Because we have to let the land rest. We know that. They didn't know that, but God told them to do that because he knew better than they do. And so one of their commands was every seventh year the land was supposed to rest. Well, how are we going to eat? Well, they were supposed to trust God. That was part of the Sabbath. Obey God. God will take care of you. But they didn't do that. So for 490 years... every seventh year, they disobeyed God and did not let the land rest. So how many Sabbaths did they miss? 70. And so God would let the land rest for 70 years. Why 70? Because that's the number that they brought upon themselves. That was the number they stole from God, and so that's the number that would be given back to him. God's not fair. God tells us everything we're supposed to do. And here, even the fact that 70 seems like a long time, it was the number they brought upon themselves. If they had only done it for less, they would have gotten less. They only went 40 years, they would have had to keep the Sabbath some of those years. And I don't want to belabor this point, but the fact is God tells us what we're supposed to do. God tells us how to use our time. God tells us when we honor him with our time, he'll give us length of days. I don't think that the Bible says length of days and long life. I think those are two different things. I think that long life is we will actually live longer, generally. That's the principle. But length of days, I personally believe, you can disagree with me, is something different. Have you ever wanted a longer day? Like, I really, really need 26 hours today. I just really do. And you don't. But have you ever gotten to the end of your day and you just, wow, flew by, got nothing done? Have you ever gotten to the end of the day and thought, wow, I just felt like I had plenty of time to get everything done? I honestly believe if we honor God with our time, God gives us the time that we need. We don't honor God with our time, God doesn't allow us to have the time that we need. God tells us how to use our money. He tells us to give and to honor him with our money. And people who say, I can't afford to do that, so I'm going to do as I please, they end up getting rid of their money anyway because God doesn't bless them, and so they don't have what they thought they were going to have, and they end up get, and then God ends up getting it either way. God tells us that we need to praise him and glorify him. And when we obey, God does it through our life. But when we disobey, God still does it through our life, but we just don't get to be blessed by it. The Bible gives us an example of that in the book of Romans chapter 9. Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, when Israel came to his door and said, let my people go, if the most powerful man in the world said, sure, I will honor your God, God would have been glorified. But he didn't say that, did he? No, he said, who's God that I should serve him? So God was still glorified, but at Pharaoh's expense. When we obey God, God blesses us. But when we disobey God, God is still fair with how he deals with us. God took 70 years from them because they took 70 years from God. When we don't obey God the way that we should, then the reaction is fair. It is equitable. When we're upset with God, we have to remember that. Number two, I'll mention this briefly as we go through. God is fair, but God is also merciful. God is merciful. 70 years is a long time, but it is also measurable. He could have given them 70 years and then just not tell them that it was 70 years. But one of the things that he continues to remind them about throughout this book is that in spite of the consequences they would face, he still wanted to do them good. He says, after 70 years, then I will bring you back. He said that several times already in this book by reminding them that he wants to do them good in the future. By the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and make sure that that's ready for them, just so we know who all's here this morning, we'd appreciate that. What he does in this chapter is he justifies everything that's about to happen. And he gives them a light at the end of the tunnel. He didn't have to do that. When God brings us through difficult times, we see God's truth. But the fact is, we can also see God's mercy. I'll give you several verses here. Psalm 103. Bible says, the Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and plenteous in mercy. He will not always chide, neither will he keep his anger forever. There are times when he has to chastise us, but he doesn't do that in order for that to be the end of our relationship. Psalm 85 says, I'll hear what God the Lord will speak. He'll speak peace unto his people and to his saints, but let them not turn again to folly. Surely his salvation is nigh to them that fear him, that glory may dwell in our land. Mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. In God is the perfect balance of truth and mercy. Just like we see when Jesus came to this earth, he was full of grace and truth. Jesus did not mince words, but he was also known to be the kindest to the people who everyone else rejected at the same time. God, in the book of Jeremiah, does not mince words, but he also does for them that which they do not deserve and brings them back. Psalm chapter 30 says, his anger endureth but a moment, and his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. God might do things in our life that we don't like and that we disagree with and that we deserve, but joy does come in the morning. That's the same kind of terminology that Jeremiah himself uses in the book of Lamentations when he laments the last captivity that comes and he sees everything broken down around him. And this time when he goes to the temple, there is no temple, and he weeps. But in the middle of that book, almost exactly in the middle of that book, he says, it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. That's in the book of Lamentations. Most of the book of Lamentations is him lamenting. We tend to not read almost any of the book of Lamentations except those two verses, because those are the ones we find encouragement in. But it's by accident that he tosses them in the center of the book for us to see where all is framed. God is just and fair, but God is merciful. Number three, This might sound a lot like point number one, and it is, but he's going to pull out something else. God is universally just. God is universally just. I can imagine that the Israelites might have understood a little bit about what he was saying. He had said to turn, and they hadn't. He had said to put away their idols, and they were still set up downtown. He had said to turn away from their fornication, and yet it's still going on in their family. And so whether they agreed that God was being unnecessarily hard, they couldn't disagree that they had heard these messages and had ignored them. But I'm sure they thought, certainly we aren't the worst. Certainly we're not as bad as Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, are we going to start talking about how good Nebuchadnezzar is now? Is he God's man? Is he blessed? I mean, if anybody has idols, they've never worshipped God. They don't even communicate with God. Why would God allow them to walk free and be blessed and not us? So God answers that objection in its seed form here in this chapter. So after talking about them, verse number 12, he moves to talk about everyone else. Verse 12, it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon. And that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity, the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolations. And I will bring upon that land all my words which I've pronounced against it, even all that's written in this book, which Jeremiah hath prophesied against all the nations. For many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of them also, and I will recompense them according to their deeds and according to the works of their hands. This is a wordy statement at the beginning of verse 14. They'll serve themselves of them also. Babylon had taken people captive and had made them their slaves, so they were served of the people. But soon, all the other nations would serve themselves of Babylon, who would be their slaves. This is the same message that Habakkuk writes. Habakkuk, at the beginning of his book, he writes at the same time as Jeremiah did. And Habakkuk writes at the beginning of his book, God, see the wickedness of our people. Bring justice. Don't overlook the iniquity. He was grieved by how wicked his people were. And then God said, yes, and I will bring Babylon to bring them captivity. And then Habakkuk said, Babylon? Babylon needs to be judged first. Our people over Babylon. And then God responds to him a couple different ways. But number one, that he knows what he's doing. But that was Habakkuk's complaint. Well, God, why would God bless Babylon instead of us? I mean, that doesn't make any sense if God's trying to be just. And here he reminds us in the book of Jeremiah that God will do what he will do in his way, but will still be universally just with everybody. And just as he will use Babylon now, he will also bring Babylon punishment later. Look at verse 15. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand. This is God talking to Jeremiah. And cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. And they shall drink and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them. Then took I the cup at the Lord's hand and made all the nations to drink unto whom the Lord had sent me. To wit, Jerusalem, and the cities of Judah, and the kings thereof, and the princes thereof, to make them a desolation, and an astonishment, and a curse, as it is this day. That's the same terminology we saw last chapter. A desolation, astonishment, and a hissing, and a curse, and was when he talked about the bad figs last week. Now this terminology, I'll say it now before I go any farther. We've seen this already in... I'm surprised I put that all the way over there. We see this already, where he says he's going to give them the wine of his wrath. A few weeks ago, when I was preaching a message on Revelation chapter 14 in Sunday night, it uses this terminology that Babylon offers its wine to the world. And God borrows that picture and he flips it around and says, I will give my wine to them. And as they drink of Babylon's wine, they drink of my wrath. And so a lot of times that picture, whether it's the cup of the wine that they drink or that God will crush the grapes in a wine press, this picture is one of God's judgment. Okay, we leave it at that. And here he says to Jeremiah, take this proverbial cup of wine of my judgment and cause all the nations to drink it. And so he says, I have done that, yes, with Judah and with Jerusalem. They will see God's wrath on them because of their sin. But then he moves on. He moves on. Look at verse number 19. To everyone else. As if God needs to remind them that it's not that he only looks at them and sees their sin. He also sees what's going on in the rest of this world. Verse 19. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his princes, and all his people, and all the mingled people, all the kings of the land of Uz, all the kings of the land of the Philistines, which would be Ashkelon, Aza, Ekron, the remnant of Ashdod. Verse 21, Edom, Moab, the children of Ammon, all the kings of Tyrus, all the kings of Zidon, the kings of the Isles, which are beyond the sea, Dedan, Tema, Buz. Imagine if you land in Buz and you put that on your letters as you sent them out, Buz. Anyway, I just thought that was funny. And all that are in the utmost corners. Verse 24, all the kings of Arabia, all the kings of the mingled people that dwell in the desert, all the kings of Zimri, all the kings of Elam, all the kings of the Medes, and all the kings of the north, far and near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Shishak shall drink after them. These are all the nations. Now, if I was a prophecy preacher, I would try to pull out every modern-day equivalent for every one of these places, and then we would see what God's doing in the grand scheme of mankind. But that's not the point of this. Because he finishes by saying, and all the kingdoms of men. The point is that these are all the people that they're aware of around them. He starts with Pharaoh, and then he goes to Edom, which is south of them, and then Moab and Ammon and Tyrus, and he wraps around. Then he talks about places that are farther away, like Arabia and all of that. These are places that they're familiar with. These are places that they've been. These are nations they know the name of. They know their kings. They know their practices. They know what they do. And they see that what they're doing, they're seeing in other nations around them. And God says, I see it all too, okay? And just as you God, just as I'm dealing with you in your life, I'm also dealing in everybody else's life too. I am universally just. I'm not just looking at you and God giving you a hard time. I'm also doing it with everybody else. All the kingdoms of the world. And it might feel like it's just us that God's giving a hard time, but God's working his plan with everybody. He may use one nation or one regime or one person right now, but their sin will be overlooked in the long run. Psalm 67 says, let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for thou shalt judge the people righteously and govern the nations upon the earth. In some senses, this is an encouragement to Jeremiah, because we can get so frustrated with people and political parties doing wicked things, almost as if when God works with us, he's just ignoring all the sin in the world. And God says, I see what I'm doing, and I might use very wicked people to perform my plan. But that doesn't mean that it just goes by, because I see it. I'm universally just. And that takes us to number four. God is universally victorious. God is universally victorious. What we realize as this chapter progresses is that when he's talking about bringing all the nations to justice, he's actually giving a prophecy about the end of time. That he will have victory over all the nations of this world. A king will reign and prosper, he says. And he will be called the Lord our righteousness. Jeremiah has already prophesied that and will again here in a few chapters. And every knee will bow before him, and they won't have a choice. There's not going to be nations on this world who will say, you know what? No, I'm not going to serve the King of Kings. He's like, no, they are going to. Look at verse 27 and 28. This is a humorous section. So Jeremiah, we've already pictured this. Jeremiah is taking this proverbial cup of wine of God's wrath and handing it to a nation. Now, he uses this picture almost like, here, drink this. This is your destruction. And like, that's the picture that's being given. And so obviously the nation's going to be like, no, I don't want to drink that. I want to live. I want us to continue. I want to be blessed. I won't want to be destroyed. That's what it says in verse 27. Therefore thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, drink ye, be drunken, and spew, and fall, and rise no more because of the sword which I will send among you. And it shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at thine hand to drink, then shalt thou say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, ye shall surely drink. Ye shall certainly drink, I'm sorry. Some nations are going to be like, you know what? No, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to surrender. God's not going to have victory over me. And he says, well, yes, you will. Jeremiah is instructed to give it to everybody, and everybody will take it. Some people refuse to believe that they will fall. Some people refuse to believe that God is involved in their life. Some people refuse to believe that God actually sees what they're doing and that God will respond to them. And God tells them, yes, I will. He says in verse 29, lo, I begin to bring evil on the city which is called by my name. And should ye be utterly unpunished? He does bring up the obvious question. If I were to react so strongly to Jerusalem, what makes you think that I would just overlook what's happening in the rest of this world? I mean, judgment must begin at the house of God, the Bible says. But if that's true, then certainly we can trust that God's going to be just everywhere else. Certainly we can trust that God sees what's going on in our world. Certainly we can trust that God's going to take care of it. And we spend our lives vacillating over what's going to happen. If we don't make things work, if we don't fix it, then God's just going to be utterly helpless. And God says, you know what? I'm using people in my time and in my way, but I see everything that's going on. I see everything that's going on, and I will take care of it. And if I would deal with my people because I'm caring about what they're doing, certainly I'm going to see everybody else. He said, I'll continue the verse. And should ye not be utterly unpunished, he asks, ye shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword upon the inhabitants of the earth, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore prophesy thou against them all these words, and saying to them, the Lord shall roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon his habitation. He shall give a shout as they that tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for the Lord hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword, saith the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coast of the earth. And the slain of the Lord shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, neither gathered or buried. They shall be as dung upon the ground. Talking about all the nations that will bow their knees before God, he will be victorious over all of them. And so he takes that picture and he brings it back to his people and makes one very obvious point at the very end. Number five, mourn when you have left following God. Mourn. Mourn, grieve, when you have left following God. So with this character in mind that Jeremiah poses, and he looks at Jerusalem, then he looks at Babylon, then he looks at everybody else and reminds them, God's being just with you, and he will be just with everybody else as well. He brings it back to his people and reminds them about his pasture and his sheep with his shepherds that he's put over them. And he says in verse 34, howl, ye shepherds, and cry, wallow yourselves in the ashes, ye principal of the flock. For the days of your slaughter and of your dispersions are accomplished, and ye shall fall like a pleasant vessel, like the picture he gave in chapter 18 and 20 of a pot that was broken. It says they will fall. Verse 35, the shepherds shall have no way to flee, nor the principal of the flock to escape. A voice of the cry of the shepherds and an howling of the principal of the flock shall be heard, for the Lord hath spoiled their pasture. The peaceful habitations are cut down because of the fierce anger of the Lord. He hath forsaken his covert as the lion. Like a lion leaves its lair, God and his protector over the people, he has left the people of Israel. For their land is desolate because of the fierceness of the oppressor and because of his fierce anger. He begins his explanation here with how God is not with them the way he used to be. And he tells them, the people who are in charge of the people, the people who are among the people, he tells them to howl and to cry and to wallow in ashes. Why? Because they are on the receiving end of God's justice and wrath, which should have been for all the nations which were falling apart and rejecting him. It was not supposed to be for them. But because God is fair and because God is just, it would be to them. But they should mourn when that's the decision that they made. What a crying shame, he says, that this is the outcome. And rather than us pointing our fingers at God, we should be pointing our fingers at us and saying, why is it that this is the outcome? Why is it that God has to do this with us? Because God is just, and so if God is to be just with us, and this is what it looks like, that is our fault. James chapter 4 says that God gives more grace. Wherefore, he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. He says, submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners. Purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Then he says this, be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. God doesn't want you to be sad. God doesn't want you to have no joy and have no peace. This is not a universal statement. Be sad. Go upon your way. He's telling you to be afflicted and mourn because you haven't done what? You haven't done everything he just said. You haven't cleansed your hands. You haven't purified your hearts. You've lived in pride, and so God is resisting you. And he says, so because of how foolish that is, allow it to bother you that this is where you are. Allow yourself to mourn because God is resisting you. Allow yourself to see the foolishness and the crying shame that it is that of all the people that God has to deal with in this world, you have to be one of them when you weren't supposed to. He says, verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. Our pride, which brings God resistance, needs to be turned into humility to recognize who we truly are and to return to him in submission. God wants us to have joy, but he doesn't want us to be happy about living in rejection against him. So he looks at his shepherds and his people and says, this should not be what it is. But because I'm fair and just, this is where we are. So howl and weep and wallow in ashes. He says in James, be afflicted and mourn and weep. Be turned to heaviness. He wants us to weep over our sin and over our foolishness to think that God, who sits on the throne of the world and will reign over everybody and everything, can be resisted and rejected and yet for some reason still be obligated to bless me. Weep over the idea that this is what has permeated our thinking. God is who he is, and we must align ourselves with him. And whenever we are disgruntled about what God is doing in our life and in our world, we have to remember his character, that God is right. That's Jeremiah chapter 25. We're going to continue on next week as we're getting to the end of this section. And there is a very beautiful section coming up here right in the middle of this book, chapters 30 through 33, that we're really looking forward to, that really puts everything into a whole Bible focus. And so we'll see that here in just a couple weeks.